This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Whenever you saw Alan Alda on the big screen or the small, he usually played a practical, well-spoken character who knows how to communicate to the audience. Now he's working to make sure that scientists around the world have those same communication skills when getting their ideas across to the public.
I think it's really important. Our lives are run on science.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about the Alda Center for Scientific Communication and find out where they're setting up shop. Then it's the story of a teacher who's improving his communication skills using stand-up comedy. And then we'll go all TMZ on you with an academic minute about celebrity health news. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Alan Alda may be best known for his role as Hawkeye Pierce on the TV series MASH, or as Senator Arnold Vinnick on The West Wing. But his current work is focused on helping trained scientists to more effectively communicate with the public. He was recently at the University of Vermont campus to help launch a new institute to further that goal. The Best of Our Knowledge's Pat Bradley reports.
Alan Alda has been nominated for and received numerous awards over the course of his career, including Emmys, Tonys, Oscars, and Directors Guild Awards, to name a few. His appearance on the Burlington campus to deliver the Dan and Carol Burak President's Distinguished Lecture Series focused on a lifelong passion, science. Alda noted that a just-issued report from the Pew Research Center finds the understanding and acceptance of science by the public has diminished. He says that's dangerous, and it's crucial to train scientists to be better able to communicate what they are doing.
It's an ambitious idea. I realize that. But I hope what will happen is that when you study science, you take it for granted that you're going to be studying communication at the same time. So that the science isn't encapsulated in your brain and you can't get it out to other people. It's really important that the public be excited by science, that funders understand it. Nobody would fund anything they didn't understand. If somebody comes to your door and says, I need $1,000 for this charity, you don't hand over the money until you find out what's going on. And if it can't be communicated with clarity and accuracy, not dumbed down, but with clarity and accuracy, then science will benefit and the whole culture will benefit.
Alda's talk initiates UVM's affiliation with the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University, where he is a visiting professor. Elizabeth Bass, director of the center, says the ultimate goal is to change the way scientists are educated.
We're hoping to embed it in universities around the country. Many scientists have told us that it's good for them. When you can talk to more different people in a way they can understand, you actually get ideas back. Well, they ask such a basic question, you may not have thought of it, but it was like, whoa, I should actually look at that. And several scientists have told us of that kind of experience they felt helped them be better scientists.
UVM is the second university to form an affiliated institute, following Dartmouth University. It will be coordinated through the university's statewide EPSCoR, or Experimental Program to Stimulate Competitive Research Project. Program Director Dr. Judith Van Houten explains that they contacted the Alda Institute to create the affiliation.
We were unhappy that we were being asked to dumb down our research in order to communicate it, and we did not believe that was appropriate. So when Alan Alda said it's important to communicate what you're doing without dumbing it down, we knew that we had the right plan to work with them. Faculty want to communicate. They don't want to live in a little ivory tower or shell, and it disappoints them when they can't get their point across.
Alda, who has had a lifelong interest in the sciences, became active in promoting science communication when he hosted the PBS series Scientific American Frontiers. He found that the people he interviewed could be very engaging when prompted to be more relatable.
We do something that's aimed at changing the way they approach the whole question of communication. They don't just think about using different words. It's not mechanical like that. They think about who they're talking to. While they're talking to them, to find out if they're getting what they're saying. And this is not something you can ask somebody to do. You got to put them through exercises, games, experiences that help them become accustomed to reading the mind of the person they're talking to. Science is so fascinating and scientists are so passionate. I want some of that passion to show when they're communicating it.
The Alda Center is holding day-long workshops for STEM and social sciences faculty. Annual workshops are planned in other fields, including the humanities. UVM and the Alda Center are also exploring the possibility of semester-long classes for graduate students. I'm Pat Bradley, WAMC News.
And after reporting on the press conference announcing the partnership between the University of Vermont and the Alda Center for Communicating Science, Pat Bradley got a chance to speak one-on-one with Alan Alda about the importance of scientists communicating their findings and ideas to the public.
I think it's really important. Our lives are run on science. And if we don't understand it, we can't make informed objections about things that we're worried about. And it's important for the public to communicate with science about ways in which science is affecting them. I mean, when you think about the controversy over vaccinations, for instance, I think you could make the case, given what science has shown over and over again, is that the worries are not well-founded about the safety of vaccinations. So I think the public needs to be communicated with in such a way that they can raise good objections when necessary, but based on real science, not based on baseless fears. And it's up to science, it's up to the scientists, I think, to communicate it with such clarity, but accuracy, so that the public is glad to get the real story. I mean, we want to know the real truth.
What's some of the biggest challenges when you're doing the workshops, when you're working with the scientists, in getting them to kind of relax and open up and really be able to talk at a layperson's level?
You know, that's one of the wonderful things about the way we work with scientists. It's so great to see it. I love to sit in on the classes or sometimes teach them, because what you see is it's not hard work to get them to relax and jump in with enthusiasm, because the games we play, and they're games, sometimes they're exercises, but mostly they're games. You see the scientists flushed with enthusiasm. They get, their blood's running, they're connecting to other people. It's a very happy experience. I mean, we're social animals, so if you can get people to connect and get in motion together and have a goal that you're trying to achieve in this game, and it can only be achieved through contact with the other person, where you're actually reading the cues coming from the other person. You're sort of reading their minds. This is an exciting state to be in. So there's no problem getting them to do it, getting them to relax. They love it.
So they're not really up in that ivory tower everybody hears about.
No, they're not. Well, they might be when they walk in the door, but they don't stay in the ivory tower. They get into everybody else's state of mind and space. And it's really exciting to see that happen.
When you were working on Scientific American Frontiers, you said that's what really led you to this. You saw the scientists really doing this. If you hadn't had that experience, do you think anybody would have found this, discovered this?
I think, I thought we were the only people teaching improvisation, for instance, to bring out this personal affect, personal presentation with the person listening. And it turns out there are a couple of other places around the country that teach improv. I don't know if they do it the way we do it. And one of the things we'll find out as we spread this method around the country and establish new centers for communicating science in universities around the country is we'll find other people's versions of these techniques, and we'll incorporate them and we'll spread them around this whole network that we're trying to establish in universities around the country. So in the same way that I didn't know that a couple of other people were doing things similar to what we're doing, what we hope is that everybody knows what the best ideas are, the things that work best, and we can spread them around and everybody can benefit from them.
So how do you do a workshop with scientists and improv?
Well, you start at the beginning, and it's not something you can describe. I can describe it for you, but you wouldn't get anything from the description. It's something you have to go through. And when you go through this process, you get transformed a little bit. It's what we don't give tips on how to communicate. We put you through experiences that help you communicate better, lead you to the point where you just naturally, with an open heart, are glad to communicate more openly, to make more personal contact with the audience, to be aware of whether or not they're understanding the technical stuff you're talking about, and to also be aware in your own head about whether or not it's accurate and that you're not dumbing it down for them, because that doesn't benefit them either. It doesn't benefit science, doesn't benefit the audience.
There's been a huge need for students in the STEM areas. Will this sort of a program, you think, open up more interest at younger ages when scientists can communicate better and get more students into those fields?
I think it will, because what it'll do, it'll put the A in STEM and make it STEAM. The art of communicating is something that science has neglected to a great extent up until now. A few years ago, I talked to some scientists about this, and an older scientist, after I was making the case for better communication among scientists, he said, his question was, why doesn't the public study chemistry? And I couldn't quite get him to see that what I was trying to work toward was where the public would, even though they're not signed up at a university to study chemistry, they can get much more of what chemistry is about, and physics and biology and so on, if it's presented to them in terms, in language, that they understand, that the way they speak. We talk to each other in stories. We talk, we use imagery. We are emotional when we talk. We use words. I was so excited today to find out that such and such happened, or you won't believe this disgusting thing I saw. Well, as soon as you say that, our ears open up. And when scientists learn to speak the way we speak, not only the words we use, but the way we tell stories to each other, then we will understand more about chemistry, because not everybody has the time to go to school and hold down a full-time job and learn chemistry, astrophysics, nuclear medicine. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff out there to learn. I want them to share that with us out of an abundance of their own enthusiasm, and then that enthusiasm will be contagious for us.
You yourself are very animated when you talk about this program and getting academic scientists and other scientists to be able to communicate. How important is this for you personally?
Well, it's important to me personally because my hobby is to try to understand more about science. So I'm constantly reading it. I'm constantly talking to scientists. Scientists have a hard time just shaking hands with me because within 30 seconds, I'm asking them about the deepest aspects of their work. And I can see their eyes sort of look dazzled sometimes because I just want to know. But what I find is they really want to tell me. They long to communicate. It's not hard to convince them to get better at communication. And that's great. That's great for me to hear, because it's really a selfish motive I have for getting them to communicate better. I want to understand more. And the better they can communicate it, the more I'll understand and the happier I'll be.
Alan Alda has done just about everything an actor can do and is now focusing on the importance of scientific communication. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Pat Bradley. Still to come, we've heard how the Alda Center uses improv to help scientists communicate. Now, how about a teacher that uses stand-up? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Brian Bowden is a teacher and a rebel. In his classroom, kids are encouraged to raise their voices instead of their hands. By teaching stand-up comedy, Brian helps the students discover their talents. We have this profile as part of Deutsche Welle Radio's Generation Change series, prepared by Annie Gilbertson.
I love to laugh.
My name is Brian Bowden. We're hanging out at the Second City Training Center. Here I teach stand-up comedy to 11 and 12-year-olds, 13 and 14-year-olds, 15 through 18-year-olds.
I took a stand-up class in the fall, Brian Bowden. The first thing that you talk to him, you think it'll just be like a normal conversation, and then he'll just say something really funny and bizarre.
Yeah, like one of the exercises I have students do is sort of write down a couple things that is odd or unique about themselves that generally people would not look favorably upon, and I want them to then write sort of a rant talking about how awesome this thing is.
Some people laugh through their teeth, goodness sakes, hissing and fizzing like snakes.
We do like a bunch of writing exercises, like taking two words and then trying to make a joke out of them, like two random words.
And people got like lascivious liger, or like a demonic dragon, and you had to make a tattoo of that on you, and then explain about how you got the tattoo.
Then there's a kind what can't make up their mind.
A lot of people get writer's block a lot, and it's because they think whatever they're putting down is stupid. But it's not. It's just a thought that isn't complete.
Like, some days I'll think I'm funny, and then some days I'll be like, I'm really not funny at all.
Confidence is important everywhere. If you're just telling someone a story or presenting an idea or something like that and you keep questioning yourself, you need to be confident if you're going to get your ideas around.
So I've had some students who, you know, didn't do well with, you know, acting and improv and stuff, but did fantastic with stand-up. I've also seen a kid, a very nerdy kid, you know, very like low confidence type kid, and he found with stand-up, he did really well. They really enjoyed it because he wasn't afraid. Like in stand-up, it's okay for you to stand up on the stage and tell everybody, "I'm a huge nerd." And it's like, "Yeah, we love it," you know. Whereas in real life, he goes to school and says, "I'm a huge nerd." Everybody's like, "Shut up!" Punch you in the head. But he gets to do it. He gets to stand on stage and he said, "I'm a huge nerd." And it's like, "Oh my god!" And the class thought that he was the funniest person in the class. And I was teaching his dad at the same time. His dad was telling me that he was getting more confident, you know. Girls were actually talking to him because he was doing stand-up, and they thought that was so brave.
I went to a girl's house that I really, really liked. We just broke up, and I pretty much went to her house. She lives in my neighborhood in the middle of the night and sang to her.
As long as it's tonight, I know it'll be all right.
Something like that. I'm not even sure. That's probably not even it. She rejected me. Hardcore. And it was hard.
Like, if you're a comedian, you definitely have like either insecurities or you see the world in a way that's way different from everyone else. Like normal people, I guess, would just go through their life. But then comedians, they just, everything they look around, they're like, oh, that could be a funny joke.
Especially the teenage part. That's where you're becoming metacognitive. You're thinking about your own thinking. You're thinking about your place in the world. What's this mean? That's why a lot of teenagers do that whole, it's not fair, it's not fair, it's not fair, because they're realizing sort of their place in the grander scheme of things. And that place is horribly unfair, and a lot of times for teenagers, there's a lot that's not fair about being a teenager. You're not allowed to go to certain places. You can't go into certain things, can't say certain things, can't do certain things. You have to behave a very specific way.
It sounds like a teenager's going, man, nobody understands me, you know? But part of what makes comedians different is that we see the world in a different way.
And we're making observations from the outside. If you're outside looking in and you notice a mistake, maybe the person who's been doing something for quite a while is sort of stuck in a routine and they don't know how to...
You can find a link to Deutsche Welle's Generation Change series on the Best of Our Knowledges page at wamc.org. Earlier, we heard how a celebrity is helping scientists learn to communicate. But can famous people also help keep us healthy? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Do celebrities influence our healthcare decisions? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Jessica Gall-Myrick, assistant professor at Indiana University's Media School, discusses the impact of media coverage of celebrities' illnesses.
From athletes' injuries to movie stars with cancer, celebrities commonly appear in health news stories, and this news can impact public health. For example, when the media reported on President Ronald Reagan's colon cancer diagnosis in 1985, calls to the National Cancer Institute about the disease increased fourfold. Why do public figures have such a pull on our health behavior? Often more so than medical experts. Research suggests that our constant exposure to celebrities via the media results in subtle but strong emotional bonds between us and them. Celebrities become our Facebook friends and eventually feel like real friends. We see them more often than some of our own family members. We don't realize the power of these bonds until the health news hits. When we hear news of a celebrity with cancer, it seems like someone we personally know has just been diagnosed. Then, intense media coverage focuses our attention on the condition in ways that typical health stories couldn't. This combination of pre-existing emotional ties with celebrities, plus heavy media coverage, and anxiety about our own risk of the health threat spurs many of us to take action. Even when celebrities don't publicly discuss their health, news coverage of their medical conditions can influence us. Our research group found that the 2011 death of Apple founder Steve Jobs led many people to talk about pancreatic cancer. More than a third of the participants in our survey also sought information about the disease. Those who felt sad or worried after Jobs' death were more likely to talk about cancer and search for information than were those with weaker emotional reactions. Many assume that emotions lead to unwise behavior. However, emotions can get us off the couch. Heavy news coverage of celebrity health can motivate people to do what they long knew they should have been doing, but just hadn't had the motivation until it popped up in their Twitter feed.
That was Jessica Gall-Myrick of Indiana University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.